And I had gone to one AA meeting in my life prior to that week. Found it absolutely uncomfortable, stupid. I didn't like the people, didn't have any desire to stop drinking. I just wanted to feel better, you know. When I look back on it, I was thinking the other day, I was talking to this group yesterday, all my life my motive has just been that. It's just been to feel okay, to not feel so whatever it is that I'm feeling at the time. And, I mean, I overshot the mark by a long way, and when my defects of character got wrapped up in it, it became a nightmare for me and everybody else. But the motive, the underlying motive wasn't a bad one. It was just, I just want to try to get life in order enough to feel okay. And I think one of the biggest misunderstandings, and it's not even because of any fault, has been the mistaken belief that I know what it is that's going to make me happy. I have spent all my life pushing, and sober too, by the way. That delusion has stayed with me in sobriety, that I know what it is that's finally going to make me happy. And it's like I'm always on the verge. If I can just get a couple more things into place, if I can just get this, get her, get rid of her, buy this, buy that, whatever it happens to be. And yet I always find out I come back to the same place of this, I mean, it's termed by different things by all of us, isn't it? This eternal restlessness, this low-grade irritability and depression. I sometimes joke that, you know, I was born disappointed. You know what I'm saying? That everything in the world was going to eventually disappoint me. And fairly soon, actually. Almost as soon as I get it. And drinking helps with that. I mean, I knew drinking brought a lot of pleasure and allowed me to engage in my own selfish pursuits, if you will, on a more regular basis. But what it really, I think alcohol did for me, exactly what we try to teach each other in AA to do. And that's live in the moment. Because I could walk into a bar with a ton of regrets about decisions I had made and about the fear of what was going to happen in the future and just tormented by my own thoughts. But once I started to have a drink with the guys, all of a sudden that stuff just didn't matter much anymore. I was living in the moment. I was living one day at a time right in the moment, which is where it's always the most peaceful. But I had to have something outside of me to bring me into it. And since I react horribly to alcohol and behave in ways, I'm one of those kind of drinkers nobody's ever said, hey, why don't you drink like Mike? Good job tonight. You're really doing well. I wish I could hold my liquor like you do. I've never heard anything like that. The kind of phrases I always used to get back when I was drinking was, what is the matter with you? Why'd you do that? Why didn't you just stop? What happened to you? You were happy. Why are you in a fight? And I had no real answers for it, except I was convinced by the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was convinced that I had two things going on. One was I was a bad drinker. I didn't mind admitting that even. I took a certain pleasure in. If some pretty young lady, especially in a bar, said to me, hey, you know, you really drink too much, it actually felt like a compliment sometimes. It was like, well, thank you, you know, so do you. Because the people I admired drank and ran hard and did the kind of things that I thought a man ought to be doing. And so I knew I was a bad drinker. I would confess that in a heartbeat. I never defended it. But I also saw a separate issue going on in my life, even bigger. I had these problems that I had to take care of. I had to get a divorce. I had to move. I had to change jobs. I had ideas of what I needed to do to get my life in order. And I'd been, obviously, if any of those had ever worked, I wouldn't have had to still fight that battle in sobriety. But they never work, you know? I got a buddy that, I won't say his name. Who told me just recently, he said, you know, if my hair was just darker again and I was a little thinner, I think I'd really be happy. And I pointed out to him, I said, I knew you when you were thinner and had dark hair and you weren't happy. But I have the same kind of thinking that goes on. It's like something seems like I ought to be able to come up with an answer to it. And I think that's another thing as an old man now that has helped me somewhat is to realize I can't know the answer. To hardly anything, not really. I think I do. I have to make decisions, of course, and be and live. But I've always struggled under the mistaken belief that I had to know the right answer of what to do next. I can't even decide what lane to be in the freeway, I mean, correctly. So I don't know how I can figure out how to handle my life so much better, and yet I struggle. And I'll tell you the things that caught my attention, not that you asked, but I'll tell you. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, wasn't, do you want to stop drinking? Because I truly didn't. I had no conscious desire. I wanted to not be in trouble. And I knew my wife, my then wife, wanted me to stop drinking, and my boss had suggested it, and a guy in a bar suggested it. I mean, people suggested it, but I didn't have the desire. But so I'm sitting around, and I heard a man once, it was a Sunday night. And he was a little old white-haired man like me, nondescript, wasn't cool. He came in to talk to us patients in this little recovery place I was in, and I was irritated that he was there. I had to quit watching some stupid TV show, so that pissed me off. And he's up there blabbing, and I'm going to get out in 2 days. I'm going to move to the beach and file for divorce and get out of selling real estate because there's too much tension in sales. And I was trying to think, but he kept talking and distracting me. And at one point he said, do you want to know what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, no, I don't want to know. Don't care. I'd been to probably 6-7 meetings by that night. And I knew what he'd found. Right? He found friends. Hey, good for you. He found God somewhere. I didn't care. He found an AA potluck. Yeah, super. And he said it a second time. You want to know what I found here? And by now, I was so mad at him. And I'm still not sure why I was that angry at him, but it annoyed me that he said it. That's how petty I am. And I'm focused on him with true hate, hoping that he would get the fact that I was pissed off. And he said, I'm going to tell you what I found. So now I'm really annoyed, since he asked us twice and was going to make us listen anyway. And he said something that absolutely got my attention and changed everything in my world. He said, what I found in AA is a higher degree of mental comfortableness. I have peace of mind. And I'd never had peace of mind that I'm aware of. Never, not really. Not in a lot of years anyway. He talked about a life. He wasn't even talking about drinking anymore. He said he was going to go home to a wife he loved. And get up in the morning and have breakfast with his kids because he wanted to, pack his lunch in his lunch pail, go off to work, get 8 hours of work, come home because he wanted to have dinner with his family, and then go to meetings and smoke cigarettes and drink coffee, and he'd never had it so good. What I'm pretty sure he described is what people in AA get when they work the steps, serenity. One of the things that caught my attention early on was people were always talking about we should be happy, joyous, and free, which is a tremendous goal to go for somebody like me who is not happy, joyous, and free. And they actually seemed like they were. I mean, I saw some I knew were phonies, right? I immediately predicted you're a phony. But some of them seemed really okay. And I've changed that a little bit for me recently. I don't know that I have to be happy, joyous, and free as much as I would like to just be content. That I'm okay right now today, whether anything changes. And that doesn't mean because everything is actually in the order I would like it to be in. I think it comes from surrender. I think it comes from a time when I've tried everything else to push for my way, maybe, or I've talked it to death, or I've prayed it to death. And somewhere along the way, it's just like, you know what? I'm done. I just want to be okay. And another thing that I will pass along without your request is just because I feel bad in sobriety doesn't mean I'm doing it wrong. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it's a direct result from negative action I've taken or whatever. But sometimes it has. Sometimes I'm working a better program when I'm feeling bad than I was the day before. Sometimes I'm praying harder, more, not begging, but just trying to make contact and know God's will. Sometimes I'm trying to surrender better than I had done. Sometimes I'm going to more meetings, helping other people and doing things because I'm in such pain. But it's not because I've created the pain. I have a natural condition that brings, that I find myself uncomfortable sometimes for reasons I can't put a finger on. And I've been lucky enough to have people teach me that it's not God's fault. That the higher power they talked about when I was new, I got to spend time with some of the old-time greats in Southern California, around them at meetings and also around them alone. One of them was Chuck Chamberlain, Chuck C., and he used to talk about surrender a lot. And he also would talk about God a lot. And I used to think, I wish I believed that. It would be such so much nicer way to believe that there's a higher power that actually takes care of the details of our life. I was raised in a fairly strict home with religion. But the God that I was aware of didn't like get involved to do things with you in the world. He was basically there just to make sure you behaved, huh? Or punish if you didn't behave. Or they talked about he was in love, but it was love for us, but you didn't go to him for like guidance and direction. You might beg for some help when you're in trouble or something, I guess. That's what I thought. But I heard these AA people talking about the fact that either they believed or they were going to try to believe that there was a higher power that actually gave them guidance and direction and gave them better guidance and direction than they did themselves. And from that, I've had 41 years sober. I was in a group of people who were 21 of us together when I was trying to get sober in that little recovery joint. And I literally got voted least likely to succeed in sobriety most of the time. Every week we would vote on each other. And they were right. But at the end of that year, only two of us were sober. And at the end of the next year, I was the only one sober. And it wasn't because I was so special, but what I was fortunate enough to have happen is I fell into the hands of one man in particular who moved out here from the Pacific Group. His name was Don Hopes. And he became my... I asked him to sponsor me, not because... My motivation for asking Don to be my sponsor was he looked wealthy. He drove a big car, he had big rings, and he was gaudy almost to the point of embarrassment. But he looked rich, and that's all I really cared about. I needed some help. And I asked him to sponsor me, and he made me start taking actions better than the way I think and feel. And included in that action was sometimes making no changes, sitting still. And if there's one thing that is terrorizing for someone like me is having to sit still when I think I have to do something about something for myself. You know, it's just really hard to just be still and see how things play out. He told me I couldn't make any major changes. I wasn't going to get a divorce. I wasn't going to move. I wasn't going to change careers for the first year. And at the end of the first year, we would talk about it. And that first year was difficult, like it is for a lot of us at least, maybe most. I went backwards financially. I was angry a lot. I was confused most of the time. When I was 90 days sober, the urge to drink hit me like a full-blown craving. It had lasted all day. I wanted to drink so bad. I was angry, which is my fallback state anyway. And I wanted a beer. And I, you know, my family didn't know any better. I could have told them we drink every 90 days. And they would have been happy. That's better than every day. And we were on vacation at the beach, and I went in the house to get my money to go to this liquor store. And instead of doing that, I got on my knees, and I said a prayer to no one in particular, filled with some anger, but not a demand, just saying, look, if you're up there and you can do anything, please do it. I can't stand feeling like this. And when I got up from my knees at that very moment, the urge to drink was gone from me. And I remember sitting there uncomfortable thinking, did I just trick myself? Did I fool myself into thinking? But it was gone and it's never come back. I've never had it come back like that. I wondered, and in the middle years, in the 20s, thinking, I wonder if I could have kept drinking. What if I'd have done this? What if I'd have... But those were just intellectual thoughts. They weren't the craving that most of us know so well, you know. I have been active in Alcoholics Anonymous because one simple reason. Sometimes I'm now active because I can help other people. But the true motivation has primarily been, I want to be okay in the world. I want to be happy. I want to be content. I would like to feel some absence of depression and confusion and negative feelings. And when I'm active in AA, I have a chance of being that way more often than not. I'm not a stupid person, I don't think, although I act stupid sometimes. But I wouldn't stay in AA if there weren't a reward for someone like me. I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't put a suit, a tie, and a jacket on tonight to speak at a meeting, except I was told to do that to show respect to AA. I was told that my behavior at a meeting had to reflect better than the way I might want to be, because I'm a kind of goofy guy. I was young when I got sober, young enough, and I'd be sitting in a meeting wanting to tease and joke, and I did do that with my buddies. And my sponsor grabbed me one night, and he took me up to the front row where he sits, and he had a seat, and he says, "This is your seat. You're going to sit in it every night. And you get here early, and you take that seat." And he'd already given me a job there. I was a trash man at the meeting, so I was there fairly early anyway. And I'm in that same seat 41 years later because he told me to do that. Now, would it matter? Would I drink if I didn't sit there? I doubt it. But on the other hand, I did what the old-timers did that seemed to be doing well in life. And, you know, it's just a... I'll keep this real short since there's so few of us, but I want to talk about a couple topics that I don't get to spend quite as much time on. One of the things that I'm convinced of, I'm going to work backwards on this one, that I have become convinced of after years of going back and forth on it. But a long time ago, it came clear to me that when the hand of God is actually working in my life, when events are starting to come into place that will eventually be to my benefit and other people's benefits, I often mistake that as something going wrong. And I'll give you an example. At the end of my first year, I started applying for work at all kinds of places that I thought they should be happy to get me. And I wasn't getting into the jobs. And I even would get real close. One day I went through three interviews with this huge corporation, and it was like a perfect job, I thought. It seemed perfect. Because things that I can't quite have always seem more perfect than the ones I actually get. But I was convinced that this job was going to save my world, my family. It was going to be a good thing. I went down to, I don't know if you know where Doheny State Park is, at the beach for the weekend camping, and on Monday I was to go sign the final papers. I drove up to a town called Glendale. And when I got there, the secretary came out. She said, "Have a seat. The boss will be out in a minute." And when he came out, he told me, he said, "Look, we've been trying to reach you all weekend." And remember, there weren't cell phones then. He said, there's a hiring freeze. There's no job. We're sorry." When I drove back down, it took me about an hour and a half to get back to the campsite. I remember thinking, "Where's God? Where's that loving God everybody talks about? What kind of God would let you get your head in the door and then slam the door?" I mean, I was furious. When I got back to the campsite, my wife had made this cake, congratulations. She had candles on it. The kids were all dancing around because it was going to fix us. And there was no work. And I was so angry and depressed. And out of nowhere, this buddy of mine that I used to drink with had gotten sober a few months before me comes roaring up on his motorcycle. He wasn't supposed to be coming down there, but he was coming down to Mucha Free Spot, I think. And I told him what happened, and he and I sat there, and he kept telling me over and over the thing we tell each other, the thing that I can't give myself, hope. He kept saying, "Look, it's going to work out. It really will be okay." But I don't know about you, but I don't believe that when I'm in the depths of anger and despair. I'm thinking, yeah, that's just all nice talk to make you feel better, but it's not really going to be all right. And shortly after that, I got a job offer to go to work as a probation officer in Orange County, California. And I told him the truth about my drug use, my alcoholism, my little minor arrests, those kind of things. And like I like to say, I was really grateful to get that job. until my first day of work. And when I got there, I thought, this is a stupid job. I don't want this job. I hate it here. They wanted me to work in Fullerton. I didn't even know where Fullerton was. I was pissed off. I called my sponsor and said, I'm not taking this job. And he said, yes, you are. You're going to stay there 1 year. And by the way, they've done fine without you until you got there. They're going to, if they tell you to stand on your head, just stand on it. And, you know, he got caught up on that one-year thing all the time. I didn't catch on for 8 years, but he did it every year. We would have something. He would tell me, we will deal with it in a year. And I'm grateful for that kind of strong sponsorship for the simple reason that when I have a concern, I want an immediate answer. I don't want to wait. I don't want you to tell me it's going to be okay pretty soon. I want it fixed tonight. Everything's urgent with my emotions. The urgency is now. Fix it. And I stayed there, and I ended up liking working with those little gangsters down there. And Bill, you may remember, I don't know, but as a result of that, there was a law school that was right near my work and where the kids were supposed to go to school. And I started going to night school and on weekends. And did the same kind of thing. Told my sponsor, after the first class, I called him up and I said, that was a stupid idea on my part. I don't want to be a lawyer. And he goes, well, nobody cares if you become a lawyer. So there, he said, but you are going to finish a class because people like you are quitters. Finish the summer school class. Can you do that? And I thought, no, I can't do that. That's like 6 weeks and I don't want to waste 6 weeks of my like I did. And I did that, and then I finished law school 3.5 years later. And, you know, on May the 30th, 1986, so that'll be coming up too this week, I got the results in the mail that I passed the bar and I became a lawyer. I've had the perfect career for me. I accidentally slipped into the district attorney's office. I thought I was going to be a real estate lawyer, and through a series of things that aren't important for this talk, and I was scared to speak in public, by the way. I forget to add that sometimes. I was so scared. Without exaggeration, if I was at a bingo game and got bingo, I wouldn't yell out bingo sometimes, afraid I'd be wrong. You know what I mean? I just can't risk making a public mistake. I'd give you the card, then I'd be mad you got the prize. But the point, I did the same thing in school. I would know the answer sometimes when they would ask, and I would be frozen. And then somebody else would get credit for it when they answered, and I'd be mad. That's the way I like to live my life. Mad at other people for me not doing what I should do. And I ended up becoming a trial lawyer. Didn't know how to even do a trial. Never took a trial course, because I wasn't going to do that. I was just going to sit in an office, I thought. I don't know what I thought I was going to do. And I ended up becoming chief deputy district attorney in charge of homicide. So I've done every kind of big major trial. It was the perfect career for me. And so I somewhat jokingly say this. Why didn't God just tell me that the first year sober? It's going to work out. It's all going to work out. You're worried about having a retirement, it's going to be fine. Don't worry about it. You're too young to be worried anyway. You got another 30 years to work, 35 years, just shut up, go to work. You're going to have a job you actually like. And I know now we do tell each other that. We just don't tell the details. It always works out. Even when seemingly bad things happen, and there are bad things. Working homicide, I got to go out to crime scenes all the time where there was terrible murders. And instead of that turning me off from reliance on a higher power, it pushed me the other direction. Because I came to see that it's not God that does bad things to people. It's people. I have such defects of character. If I'm angry enough that I want to get revenge on you, I can hurt you. I can do bad things to you. That isn't God. And so I quit blaming God a long time ago when tragedy happens in the world. I have a friend named Barbara up in Oregon, and she talks about the time that she'd been to the doctors and got diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And she went to her women's group that evening and was sharing about it and talking about, I guess, being angry with God. Where was God? A question most of us ask when tragedy hits. And some lady, her, I don't know if it was her sponsor or somebody, it doesn't matter, I guess, came up to her and said, "Barbara, God was just as sad as you were when you got the news. He'll be there to help you." And that's the position I've taken with the higher power. Now, I'm not always confident about the higher power, what he does or doesn't do. And I have ideas today that when I die, God, if the God talks to us, he may say to me, "You know what? You're an idiot. You had it all wrong." But I don't care. You know, it brings me some peace of mind. I was at a meeting one night. One of the guys I sponsor impromptu shared that to the group that he had gotten a 3-day notice. He'd been evicted from his rental. And he added this, "I think God was trying to teach me a lesson." And I pointed out to him after the meeting, I said, "Mark, that wasn't God, that was your landlord who was trying to teach you that lesson." But you know, I do the same kind of thinking. And part of that is just being a human, I think. It doesn't make any difference. Here's what I know tonight for certain. By working the steps, and sometimes I did them just because I was in pain. Sometimes, you know, it's, Bill Wilson writes in the 12 and 12, the pain is the touchstone of spiritual growth. I am, by nature, a depressive, unhappy man. That is my normal state, I think. Well, not always, but it's there a lot. I regress to that several times every day, I think. But anyway, but being uncomfortable in my own skin sometimes gives me a choice to do one of two things. Sit and pout and complain to everybody, which I've done, or to do something. And it can be anything. Sometimes I don't even have the strength to do something to get out of my own bad mood, my own prison of my own thoughts. I'm tortured by my own mind more than anything else. Chuck Chamberlain used to always say, when he spoke, "I've come out here to tell you monkeys two things. Quit thinking and surrender." And I would sit there and think, how do you quit thinking, for God's sakes? I would love to quit thinking. I'm so tired of my own mind. But when you're so fearful, how do you not think? When you have to figure out an answer to every problem, how do you not think? So today, I can report, I may be a slow learner than most, but the reality is, today I haven't had to figure out any big answers. And it's not because things aren't going on. There's nothing huge going on, but there's enough that I could work myself up into some negative stuff. But I've been real busy in AA the last few weeks, even more than you. I stay busy anyway. I've had a commitment to that home group I was telling Bill about earlier for 41 years, sitting in the same chair. I told you guys, I have another meeting. I don't miss those meetings almost no matter what. Once in a while I have to, but very seldom. And then I have the other ones that I fill in. And then sometimes, lately, especially with Zoom, there's a lot of AA commitments that I have been fortunate enough to be involved in. And on those weeks, I've had less time to sit in my own misery. So here's what I know for a fact for the people that I've known well in AA. We have all had lives that have included some really outstanding, surprising, almost miraculous things, if not miraculous. Some adventures that have been tremendous. And we have also had times when there's no feeling of any kind of connection to a higher power or life or anything else. And that's okay, as long as I take the actions of sobriety. I've been talking several times about Chuck Chamberlain because he was my hero as far as the idea of surrender and God goes. But he said something else, and he says it in that book, New Pair of Glasses, and he said it at that talk at Palo Mesa that year he did that, where he said he went through a period of time, something had gone bad in his business. He thought he had this big thing set up, he was going to retire, and it turned out his partner had not done that for him, and he lost it all. And he went through that period where he said he had a whole year where praying was like blowing smoke up a chimney. It had no effect. And that was good news to me. I need to hear from everybody honestly sometimes, if they're feeling this way, that sometimes AA doesn't even seem to work. It's okay to say that out loud, to say that sometimes I don't know, to say sometimes, how to, to say I just don't have any trust right now. But I go to meetings to get what I can't give myself. And major thing I go to get is hope. Because when I'm feeling down, I hear somebody else. I may not even believe it that night. I may think they're just being full of crap and I'm in a bad mood and heck with it. But like I said, I know from experience that when I asked the higher power to remove my desire to drink, it was removed. And I've had a life that has been truly outstanding. And I'll finish with this. Having told you a lot of the good things that have happened to me, I also learned from that good things outside of me don't fix me. Not really. Having a great job. I've been on television. I've been in the newspaper. I've been on 60 Minutes. I've had a lot of nice things happen because of my work. And those were all good experiences. But they don't fix somebody like me. Because my depression and my loneliness and my inability to feel like I fit in sometimes, it's got nothing to do with what kind of car I'm driving, who I'm dating, what kind of attention you're giving me. The emptiness is inside. And so I need to have an answer that fixes that, and that comes through just the act of surrender. So that's it. I ended up talking more than I thought I would, Bill. Sorry.
I'm super glad that you found a thread to follow there, Mike, because I know we were a little dismayed that it was just the two of us here for a few minutes, or the three of us with Mike, and now we've gathered a few other folks. I wonder if you might be open to a few questions.
Oh, sure.
Yeah? So I was trying to scribble some that I thought might be interesting to me and hopefully to some others. I'll make this as brief as I can, and then we'll open up to a discussion. First question, you mentioned you were young when you got sober. How old were you when you got sober?
Well, it's not young now. I was 31 when I got sober.
All right.
Now kids can be at 12. But no.
Yeah, and what happened to bring you to a place where you were willing to try to get tried again?
No, that is a good question. I was on my second marriage. Am I getting feedback?
Yeah, I think I found it.
Okay. I was on my second marriage, and I was miserable. I mean, absolutely. I was going to the bars every day, at least Monday through Friday. I didn't drink a lot on weekends, which I look back on as very bizarre. But I drank horribly Monday through Friday, you know. I would go in there around noon, start to have a beer with the guys, and stay till they closed. And by the way, I had this. I used to drink with a buddy from work named Raul. And whenever the bartender would yell out, "It's closing time, you know, last call," start to turn on the lights, Raul would jump off the bar stool and grab everybody's hands next to him and go, "Keep coming back." And so we all did that in a circle. I didn't know that was AA. That was the only thing I was familiar with when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. He gave me my first big book. He suggested I go to AA. Now, he's sitting in the bar with me suggesting AA, so that gives you a clue about my behavior. But I was just absolutely miserable. And my former wife, who I talked to today, we do get along well. And my mother started going to Al-Anon. And things got uncomfortable at home. My wife learned detachment. And she missed the with love part, I somewhat jokingly say. But it was uncomfortable. I mean, I'm used to coming home to at least a fight about what have I been doing or some kind of comment. And she would just walk right by me. And I just got horribly uncomfortable. I went up to Las Vegas, and I had a weekend come true that was a man of my low morals. Was a perfect weekend, let me just put it to you that way. I enjoyed, I would have stayed forever. It was like Tijuana. I almost wish when I was 18 I had to move to Tijuana and just live there. You know, it had everything I wanted at a fairly good price. But I'd been up in Las Vegas, and I got so sick. I always had bad hangovers. I drank in blackouts, and I was hungover. I'd done Quaaludes that weekend. I'd never done Quaaludes before. I was just miserable. And I got home, and I knew I was in a lot of trouble. And I'd been going to a therapist, a couple of them, for the few months beforehand. And this one little lady, she tried so hard, named Mary, would say, why don't you try Alcoholics Anonymous? And you know how I don't know how you felt. I sometimes seem to know something about things I know nothing about. You know what I mean? I thought, it's a terrible place. Who would go there, for God's sakes? I'd been to an all-night bachelor party one day, right before one of my appointments with Mary. It was such a good party, I'd stayed the night. And I got up in the morning, and there was some beer, ice-cold beer in this keg. And I had some beer just to kill some of the hangover. And I had to drive over to this morning appointment. And I walk into Mary's office, and she always... I mean, my life's like this giant confusion. And I would go in there, and hers was always peaceful. And she had a little lamp on her desk. And it's kind of like a police station, you know. Very quiet when you're after all the chaos. And that was one of the days she said to me, I don't know why. Why don't you just try Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, I don't even know what you do there. What do you do there? And she gave the best answer, a true answer, that she could give me. But she said, you know, it's hard to explain. She said, we go to meetings, and we drink coffee, and we just laugh, laugh, laugh. And I thought, how sad. What a pathetic way to end up in life. I've been at a bachelor party, for God's sakes. She thought that was fun, drinking coffee out of a styrofoam cup. So I held off. But when I got back from Las Vegas and I was in such trouble, I went to my first meetings. And again had that terrible feeling. I mean, I'm shy. If I don't know you. And so I walk in with these... I'm not a joiner of any kind of club. You know, I never joined any animal club like moose, elks, anything like that. I'm just not. I hang around with my friends. We make fun of people. But I can't walk in and socialize real well with people until I get to know them or at least have a few drinks. And I walked into that meeting and I was scared. And when it dawned on me they were actually asking people to speak, I was terrified. And it was a participation meeting and I was sitting right near the leader. And so I would do anything so he wouldn't call on me. I was sick to my stomach. I don't know why I was too stupid to get up and leave, but I was terrified to even do that, so I froze. But I often suffer from simultaneous conflicting emotions, and as soon as he didn't call me, my feelings were hurt. You know what I'm saying? It's like, well, who are you? By the time the meeting was over, I didn't like him. I didn't like anybody in there. It was like, what a terrible place. And my wife asked me, she said, what do you think when I got home? She was all hopeful. And I told her, it's terrible. It is terrible. And I made her a promise that I wouldn't drink for 30 days if she would never mention AA to me again. And I made it 10 days. And I was in my backyard. It was a Saturday. And I'm thinking, why did you say 30 days, for God's sakes? Why didn't you say 10 days or 2 days? You're a man. You can drink whenever men can drink whenever they want to drink. And I was off on what was going to be my last run. When I woke up on May the 30th, 1980, I'd spent the night away from home again. I was on this guy's couch. I was hungover. I was sick to my stomach. And I got in my car and I started drinking some Coors. It was about 6:30 in the morning, 7 o'clock. I had a chocolate milkshake with it, which is not a good mix, but I did it. And I took a Black Beauty for some energy. And I had a feeling come over me that I guess is best described as just a sadness, a loneliness. I didn't know where to go. I mean, I could have gone home. I could have gone to my buddy's house, my connection's house. I could have gone a lot of places. But I went back to that place that had that meeting because they had a 3-week program, and I checked myself in just to get out of the world. That's all. You know, when I was new and I heard people say things like, newcomer, if you drink again, You're going to lose your family. You're going to lose your job. You're going to die. I honestly thought those should be the promises. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, I'm ready because I just wanted out. That's what got me in there. Long answer to a short question. But it had nothing to do with I wish I could not drink again because I wanted to drink.
Thank you, Mike. And I'm curious, how long were you sober before you took on your first sponsee?
It was in the first year or 18 months that I actually had a real one. I got a little group. I started going on a panel on Sunday nights, like that guy had done for me, into this program they had in town. It moved a couple times, changed names, but it didn't matter. So I used to go one Sunday night a month on this panel, and I started picking up guys as a sponsor at that deal. You know, and a lot of them, the ones that are still alive, are still here. Yeah.
And how long did it take for you to go through all 12 steps?
Not long. But in reality, maybe 6 months. I thought I went through them right away, and did. I mean, did a cursory inspection of them. You know, one thing I also have come to the conclusion of about the steps, I don't really have to understand the terms or take them in the sense that I used to think people have to take them. For instance, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. First step. I don't know when I ever admitted I was really powerless over alcohol. I knew I drank badly. I knew that there was wording in the big book from the doctor's opinion and from people in meetings that we were powerless over alcohol. But I don't know when it clicked in my mind that I really believed I was powerless, because I always believed that, yes, I drank too much. But first of all, I believed it was a choice. I didn't realize that that choice was driven by a craving that I didn't understand. I believed I was actually making the choice. I don't think I ever went out once and thought to myself, let's not drink too much tonight. I drank to drink. You know, I drank to be drunk. Sometimes other people would suggest I limit it, but I... So, to answer your question of when I understood the steps enough to really take them, it took a long time, but I went through them and did the best I could with them. I accepted the fact that maybe I was powerless over alcohol. The concept of unmanageability of life, I think, is a lifelong learning experience. I don't know what you think. I know what it means intellectually, but I don't know what it means practically until I try to do it. Because the biggest confusion I have, and again, the reason I like sponsorship so much, strong sponsorship. I'd be at a meeting and everybody would go, just do the footwork. Yeah, I go, yeah, do the footwork. I get in my car and realize I don't know what the footwork is. The footwork to me is getting done whatever I want done. Making something happen is the footwork in my mind. When sometimes the footwork may be do nothing. The hardest thing for somebody with my anxiety to do is do nothing. Sit still. So, but I had done, when I was I got sober at the end of May, so beginning of June. By October, I was at a party one night with my former wife. Everybody was laughing and having a good time. I'm trying to fit in. They're drinking. It's not a horrible drinking party either, but I focus on all the drinking. I'm sitting at a table smelling all the drinks, pissed off. She's having a nice time. The happier she is, the more angry I am. But pretending I'm not. But inside, I'm ready to kill someone. And I went home, and I was just in a fury. And that's when I did my four step. I talked to my sponsor. I said, I'm just so angry. I have a problem with anger. So I did that and right away did the fifth and went and made my amends within a few weeks. So really in about 6 months, I had tried to work all the steps with a weak understanding of what that meant.
So you mentioned that you're coming up on 41 years sober. I'm curious, in that period of time, have you had more than one sponsor?
I've had four because the other three have died. That's one way to get rid of them, is outlast them. My original sponsor had moved to Oklahoma after we were together probably 10 years. But he stayed in my life. I liked it. He changed his name. I still talked to him all the time till he passed. He changed his name, his title, from sponsor. He said he was my illegitimate father. And so we would go places and say, I'm Mike's illegitimate father. And people, waitresses would go, oh, okay. Yeah. But he still was there and guided me a lot. I had a man named Cliff Roach. I don't know if you ever heard of him or saw him. He was a tremendous AA guy for a lot of years. And then when he was getting older and sicker, I was going through a bad relationship in sobriety with a drunken woman that I was dating. That's always fun to do. You know, I used to think the only problem with bad drinking was other people's reaction to it, right? That if we could just get away from people who were crybabies about it, we'd all have a good time. I'll tell you something. Sitting on the other side of people when they're drunk and listening and tell the same funny story 100 times is not funny. It is annoying. And watching the blackouts and doing that, I learned a whole different perspective. But because of that, a man named Lynn Wilder, who was a really well-known AA in here, one night said to me, why don't you start going to the men's Al-Anon meeting with me in Laguna Beach? They'd started one down there. And so he and I, he became my Al-Anon sponsor and overlapped Cliff, and then Cliff passed, and Lynn became my... And then Lynn died 3 or 4 years ago. And Bob Darrell's my sponsor now. I don't know if you know Bob out of Las Vegas, but, yeah.
I've had the great fortune to meet Lynn and attend that Al-Anon meeting, in fact.
It's a good meeting, Tuesday night, men's...
Strong group of men there. You've used a term a couple of times, and I'm just curious for you, what does the term active in AA look like?
It means for me having meetings that I go to no matter what, and I mean no matter what. That was the first requirement for me with my sponsors. And my sponsor didn't tell me go to 90 meetings in 90 days. My sponsor didn't read to me from the big book. There are a lot of things that I hear people talk about that they got. And here's the other thing I realized. It doesn't matter how we're raised in AA. We can still be sober and happy, joyous, and free. I had parents that raised me a certain way, and you had parents that raised you a certain way. And we all came up with our good points and our bad points, I guess, because of that child rearing. But it's the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous as far as I'm concerned. So what Don told me was you're to go to 3 meetings a week, these 3 meetings that I go to, no matter what. You can go to as many as you want, but you're going to those. So that started it. And then he made me have a job at each of the meetings. I had to come early. And I told you, I'm real self-conscious of meeting people in a group that I don't know. And plus, they all look like phonies to me, even in AA. I mean, you walk in, they're all laughing and shaking hands. I'm thinking, it's like the Rotary or something. I'd never been to Rotary, but it seemed like it would be like the Rotary. So I'm scared to death going in there. And he made me do things like go around and meet people. First, he told me to go meet 5 people. One night, he told me to meet 10. Then he made me a greeter at the door. I had to stand at the door and meet everybody at the Casablanca meeting. There were 200 people. I'm the only greeter. I was embarrassed. I complained all the time about being left out or I don't know. I was always a complainer. He had me... I told you, I was the trash man at that meeting, and then I became the mop boy. And then when we finally got carpet, I became the carpet cleaner, the vacuum guy. I kept that job 8 years. I mean, I liked those jobs. Even when I was secretary of the meeting, I did it. At least I jumped in with them. And then the other thing was to try to work with other people whenever I could. And I was taught to never say no to an AA request, which is a very interesting concept sometimes. But those were the things, you know.
So that leads into the next question I was going to ask, which is, from your perspective and in your own opinion for you, what is the best service? What service do you enjoy the most?
Wow. After a talk that I like, I enjoy talking. On the nights I don't like my talk, I hate talking and think it's the stupidest service. I did one last weekend. A couple of friends came in from other places. I was going to hang myself after the talk. It was like, oh, my God. Now, I don't know how bad it really was, but I'm pretty sure. So that's up there. I like talking to my guys one-on-one. You know, I have a group of guys. They start calling at 6:30 in the morning, Monday through Friday. Most of them have set times. A couple of them cheat. And so for the next couple of hours every morning, I'm on the phone with them. I think that's my favorite thing.
It's almost like you're reading from my sheet, because the next question I have for you is, how do you respond when sponsees don't respond to what you might call strong sponsorship?
I pout. I depends. some days, depending on how minor I think the offense is, if you will, I just figure out, F them, who cares, good luck. Other times, I'm angry, and I have to watch that in me because it's a fallback defect of character for me. I'll give you an example. Because of COVID, we started having, first it was a smaller group of them, and then it became most of them in the area, come over to my house on Wednesday nights, and we have our own meeting. All right. Now, that's not convenient to me to have a bunch of guys coming over every Wednesday. It means I'm kind of trapped. So after we did it for a while, a few of them started missing more and more. Now, if it were a regular meeting, I wouldn't have been as annoyed, but it's my house. And I told them, I said, this isn't a drop-in meeting, for Christ's sakes. It's a baby and a sponsee meeting. We were called babies when I got sober, right? We didn't have the beautiful term sponsee. But I found myself mad. So I'll be honest with you. I mean, I was mad at him. And I'm trying not to show it as much, but I'm making little digs. I'm trying to manipulate in little ways by smart aleck remarks. And then finally, I just told a couple of them, look, if you don't want to come, you don't need to come. But I found myself in such a knot over that, that there came a day and I thought to myself, either have the meeting and people come willingly or they don't. But don't set a rule like that. That's an unfair rule to people and to you. But that's how I responded. The initial response was a poor response. As time went on, it was like, it's not that big a deal anymore. And it was no longer a big deal. If it's something I worry about that's really going to, I think, threaten their lives or livelihoods, or I have concern, but I also realize I can't control people, you know.
Did your attitude about those things evolve as a function of your exposure to Al-Anon at all? Or
I believe so.
Yeah?
I believe definitely. You know what? One of the things, Lynn, one of the first things he told me that I had to do, and this isn't a direct response to that question, but I'll get to that, I think. He had little phrases that were, I would call him to complain about my then-girlfriend, the drinker. And, I mean, it was a rough deal, too. It went on off and on for a couple of years. And he would tell me, he said, you can get off the elevator anytime you want to. And he had a way of releasing me that was as valuable a lesson in release of other people's behavior, in addition to just giving words to me like, hey, let it go, let do that. He would just do that, right? He also had another thing. You've heard it probably in the Al-Anon, those of you who have been. But that, I'd never heard this. He said, no is a complete sentence. I want you to learn to say no to people. I didn't realize how hard that was for me. I mean, if it was something I hated, it wasn't too hard. But he would tell me I had to practice it. And he also added this. He said, you can change your mind in the conversation, but what I want you to do, like for this week, no matter what people ask you to do, you first have to say no. And he said, later on in the conversation, you can then say, well, you know what, maybe I'll do that, or whatever you want to say. But you got to get over that fear or concern about saying no. You know, there's a Dr. Harry Thiebaud. I don't know if you've heard of him or not, but he was a psychiatrist. He's mentioned in the back of the big book. Great. He's got great writings, doesn't he? I mean, he's got some stuff that nail my personality. But one of the things he talked about was his patients. He was a psychiatrist, and he said that alcoholics that he worked with were very compliant. They would always say yes to things. Very agreeable, very willing. He was warning other doctors how tough it is to work with us, right? And he said they're the kind of people that will say yes to things like, if you want to go, do you want to go to the theater in 2 weeks? Yes, I'd love to go. Get the tickets until the time comes. And then they don't want to go. And that fits me to a T. Huh? I say yes to a lot of AA things. And then the day comes where I actually have to show up and do it. And it's like, I don't want to do that. Why did I say yes? I'm not going to say yes again. Huh? But it's just all mental nonsense.
Well, I think you probably have already answered a question close enough to this one, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Has anyone ever sat in your chair? You mentioned you have the same chair every Thursday night. Yeah.
Oh,
and what'd you do?
The trauma was terrible. I came in and there was some guy sitting in there. And I don't know if he'd never been to the meeting before, so I couldn't be rude. Like I would have normally been rude to somebody I know. Like, get out. I think that night I actually just sat somewhere else and pouted. It felt odd to me. So what I've done since then is I get there early enough, I put my stuff on my seat, and nobody gets it. It means I have to get there like at noon for an 8 o'clock meeting, but I...
Awesome. So I'll ask you one last question, and then we can move on to maybe letting some of the other folks participate. I know the answer to this because I'm a great fan of AA history, and I've read a lot of the books that you've talked about. But some of the folks that are with us might not be familiar with who Chuck Chamberlain is. If you had to share with someone who hadn't heard of Chuck Chamberlain, how would you describe him?
Chuck Chamberlain was one of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous who was, we don't have AA stars, okay? But Chuck Chamberlain was as close as I think somebody could get to it. He was a bad drunk who got sober. He was already fairly successful in his life and came into AA after a real bad run of about a month being drunk and started to attract attention to himself, not intentionally, I don't believe, but simply because of the persona he had and because of his unmistakable beliefs about a higher power. Whether people accepted those as reality for themselves or not didn't seem to matter. He generated a feeling that maybe he really did know what the higher power was. There was something about him. He became a delegate from out here way, way before any of us were, maybe even some of you alive or me sober. As a footnote, his son is a very famous actor. by the last name of Chamberlain also. But that wasn't what made him somebody, because back in those days, the son was nobody. He became a delegate, and he told the story like this. He would go back to New York to the meetings for the delegates, and he never bothered Bill Wilson, our founder, ever. Never asked for a moment of his time. And he said one time when he was back there, Bill said to him, "You know, Chuck, you've come back here for 2 years and you've never asked to spend some time with me. I think it's time we get acquainted." And they became fast friends. And Bill and Lois Wilson used to come out and stay with Chuck and Elsa Chamberlain in Beverly Hills. And he became a person who spoke all the time in AA, gave almost the same talk all the time in AA, almost verbatim sometimes. But his focus was more on surrender and letting God run our lives than any other human I've ever heard talk about it. And again, to me, as a newcomer at least, he seemed to live that. Now, here's what I also know. I'm going to add this. My AA heroes included him and some of the others that you know. One of them died last year. And you'll get a lot of people to tell you any kind of dirt they can on them. Gladly tell you. Well, you know, they weren't saints, you know. Well, really, that almost makes them better in my eyes. I'm glad they're not saints because I'm not a saint. I'd like to be, but I'm not. I'm never going to be. When I realized my parents were humans and had big failings, how disappointed I was in a certain way. That sort of happened a little bit with some of those guys, but not with Chuck. I mean, I didn't care what they accused him of. I didn't care. He invited me to his house one day alone to sit and listen to him. He didn't know me from Adam. He really did the things he said he would do. He carried the message to other people because he wanted to. Now, he had a great life, and he got a lot of attention, and he was a big shot in AA, if you will. But that's who I think Chuck was. He was the most spiritual human being I've ever met in my life, period.
That was great, Mike. Thank you so very much.